case, and it would be a challenging one, but it's a winnable one. So that is the state of the technical legal arguments involved, but they all spring from the fact that he was obligated, if he was a member, to disclose it at the time of his immigration and citizenship application.
Now, David Duke has defended Sebastian Gorka on Twitter, writing, quote, "How is Sebastian Gorka a Nazi? The man is not only pro-Israel, he is also pro-Jewish. Strange time to be alive. They've truly lost it," David Duke wrote.
Yes. Well, there is a phenomenon that we have commented on in the forward where you have people who, because of the role Israel plays in the Middle East and because of their bias against Muslims, they like Israel. And yet, domestically, they can be anti-Jewish. It is possible to be anti-Semitic and pro-Israel. It's a phenomenon that's emerged. I don't know if Gorka is that. As I said, we have never found that Gorka wrote anything anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. What we found are these troubling associations. He said in his White House official statement that it was absurd and outrageous for anybody to say that he was anything other than opposed to anti-Semitism. I don't know how you define opposition to anti-Semitism, but partnering with a group like Vitesse Rand and with former members of the far-right anti-Semitic Jobbik Party would exclude many definitions of being opposed to anti-Semitism.
Larry Kohler asks us, I want to thank you for being with us. Larry is the Forward's editor for Special Projects. We'll link to your piece, exclusive Nazi allied group claims top Trump aide Sebastian Gorka as sworn member. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Ariel Boone. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Noreen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
The KBOO Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artist in Residence program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KBOO 2017 Artist in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboo AIR 2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from ADX, a collaborative hub offering access to shared wood, metal, screen printing, jewelry, and digital design shops through a monthly membership program. The ADX Makerspace Learning Center and Fabrication Shop allows people to bring their ideas to life. Open every day at 417 Southeast 11th in Portland and at ADXPortland.com. Coming up next is your Friday KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler commits the city to a greener future.
Tiny houses have been proposed as a short-term solution to homelessness.
The Washington State Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the Vancouver Oil Terminal.
Yeah.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 17th, 2011, or rather 2017, day 57 of the Tobacco. I'm Liam Delza.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Multnomah County and the City of Portland are considering a novel way to make low-cost housing available. Build tiny houses in homeowners' backyards and rent them out to homeless families with children. The tiny houses, referred to as accessory dwelling units, would help fill a short-term need for low-income housing while the recently passed Portland Housing Bond is implemented. Under the plan, the low-cost tiny houses would be built at no cost to the homeowner, with the expectation that they would act as a landlord for 5 years. After that, they would become the owner of the small homes. The project would start out with 4 test homes this summer, with a 300 additional units being built next year if the test works out. The proposal, initiated by the Multnomah County Idea Lab, would be administered by the Joint City-County Homeless Office. Studies have indicated that Portland needs at least 24,000 additional low-cost housing units to meet the demand.
The Republican Party's health care bill is moving through Congress, but opposition from organizations and even from inside the party is growing. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has more.
The Republican Party's health care bill is moving through Congress, but opposition from organizations and even from inside the party is growing. AARP has come out against the American Health Care Act as well, saying it will hurt many Americans in a variety of ways. Jerry Cohen, state director of AARP in Oregon, says under this legislation there will be an age tax, allowing insurers to charge older Americans 5 times what they charge younger Americans. Currently, they are limited to charging rates 3 times higher. Cohen says that's going to mean a big hike in premiums.
It's a fatally flawed formula for the health care of older Americans, their families, and communities.
Republican supporters say the bill will lower the federal deficit and increase health care choices for Americans. Analysis from the Congressional Budget Office released this week found the bill would save the federal government $330 billion over the next decade. However, it also found that 24 million people would lose their health coverage over that period, and that insurance premiums would increase 20-25% for people at retirement age. Cohen is concerned the bill will weaken Medicare as well, drying up funds earlier than expected, which will shift costs to states and potentially open the program up to becoming a voucher system. He says Medicaid would not be spared either.
It harms our long-term care system because of the projected $800 billion-plus in cuts to Medicaid. And Oregon has been very good at being able to keep seniors and adults with disabilities living at home. It's been a great program, and it would be at great risk if this were enacted.
Cohen says prescription drug prices could rise under the bill and that the bill includes a $200 billion tax break to drug and insurance companies. He says the bill does not help with the escalating cost of health care.
This particular piece of legislation that we consider a special interest bill, not an American Health Care Act, is certainly one that fails to address those fundamental questions and concerns that have been raised by all Americans.
Cohen says Oregonians should speak to their representatives in Congress about the bill. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
In a speech to the Oregon Environmental Council and 350.org, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler called climate change the most pressing global issue that we face. In the talk, which was given as part of the Let's Talk Climate town hall, the mayor committed Portland to a leadership position going forward. He told the attendees that, quote, "We are now the line of defense, but I'm not going to settle for that. We're going to become the line of offense," end quote. He stated that one of his primary goals is to move the city to 100% renewable energy usage by 2050, and also indicated opposition to the Portland Development Commission's plan to build a parking garage in the Rose Quarter. Michael Armstrong, the deputy director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, also addressed the group and pointed to a number of areas where the city will work to reduce carbon emissions. He specifically referenced urban land use, transportation, energy supply, and building efficiency, among others.
Now here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell with a view, review, and commentary on this week's fabrications from the Republican administration.
Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts.
This week, the American Health Care Act dominated much of the discussion in Congress and the media. As a candidate, as president-elect, and since inauguration, Mr. Trump has been promising great, great health care.
Everybody's got to be covered. This is an un-Republican thing for me to say. That's what I do. I do a good job. You know, I mean, I know how to do this stuff. We're going to repeal it and replace it. And it'll be great health care for much less money.
I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare with reforms that expand choice, increase access, lower costs, and at the same time provide better health care.
Tom Price recently confirmed Secretary of Health and Human Services and longtime foe of the Affordable Care Act also assured us that all would be well.
I firmly believe that nobody will be worse off financially in the process that we're going through.
However, Monday's release of the analysis by the Congressional Budget Office quickly caused this pyramid of lies to collapse. The report estimated that 14 million fewer people would be insured in the first year and that the number would rise to 24 million by 2026. An independent White House analysis actually put the number at 26 million by 2026, but considering the administration's grasp of facts, they may have simply confused the year with the headcount. The new plan increases the premium that insurers can charge older customers from 3 times to 5 times as much as they charge younger ones. It also replaces the income-based tax breaks that were a key element of Obamacare with a very modest series of age-based tax breaks. Taken together, these two changes can be catastrophic for older Americans not of Medicare age. For example, a 64-year-old making $26,500 a year, which is only $14,400 above the federal poverty level, would pay on average $1,700 a year for health insurance under Obamacare in 2026, but $14,600 under the House bill. In other words, paying for their health insurance would push them back below the federal poverty level. However, there actually are potential savings associated with the Republican American Health Care Act. The CBO estimates that the ultra-wealthy would see huge savings and the federal deficit would be reduced by $337 billion in the next 10 years. Not surprisingly, the CBO report brought an immediate chorus of objections. California Democratic Congressman John Garamendi, who used to be that state's insurance commissioner, had this comment.
You'll pay more for less. And there's a huge, very, very serious tax cut, almost all of which goes to the super wealthy and the upper 20% of America's income.
Since Garamendi is a Democrat, this is probably not surprising. But this is what Tom Cotton, Republican senator from Arkansas, said.
As it's written today, this bill in the House of Representatives cannot pass the Senate, and I believe it would have adverse consequences for millions of Americans, and it wouldn't deliver on our promises to reduce the cost of health insurance for Americans.
Oregon Republican Greg Walden evidently doesn't share these concerns. Walden represents Oregon's 2nd District in the U.S. House of Representatives and is the chairman of the powerful House Committee on Energy and Commerce. The American Health Care Act sailed through Walden's committee, a fact that he shared proudly.
I appreciate it. It's great to have the markup behind us. I think our committee did incredibly important and good work. Came to, I think, a very good work product at the end. But this is major entitlement reform. We're going to restore power to the states.
When we repeal and replace Obamacare, it will amount to the biggest entitlement reform probably at least the last 20 years, certainly since the Clinton days when they reformed welfare. And what we want to do is restore power to the states, put Medicaid on a budget.
Walden's position shouldn't really come as a surprise. Clinton may have beaten Trump 50% to 39% in the general election, but 28 of Oregon's 36 counties voted Republican, including all 20 counties in Walden's 2nd District. So how would the proposed health care law affect Oregon? You heard Walden brag about reining in Medicaid. The Republican bill reduces Medicaid spending by $880 billion by the year 2026. That's a 25% reduction in funding levels to the states. Oregon is one of 31 states to implement expanded insurance coverage under Obamacare. Today, over 1 million Oregonians, that's one out of every four people that lives in this state, is covered by the Oregon Health Plan. To qualify, you must earn less than 138% of the federal poverty level. For a family of four, that's $24,600 per year. 75% of the funding for the Oregon Health Plan comes from Medicaid. The balance is covered by the state. What happens when Medicaid funding to the state is cut by 25%? Like many other states, Oregon is already struggling with budget deficits, so there's no way the state can make up the difference. We can look forward to hundreds of thousands of Oregonians losing their health insurance. This will hit the poor and older workers not yet eligible for Medicare the hardest. And where are those people? Certainly some are in urban areas, but if you look at county-by-county demographics for the state, a large percentage are Congressman Walden's constituents. Median household income by county in Oregon ranges from $34,565 to $66,514 annually. 16 of the counties in Walden's 2nd District fall below the Oregon median, including 10 of the poorest counties in the state. Then there's age. On average, 20.5% of Oregon's population falls in the age range of 55 to 64 years old, the most expensive time to buy health insurance under the new Republican plan. 15 of the counties in Walden's 2nd District have a higher percentage of the population in that danger zone than the statewide average. In all likelihood, the Oregon congressional district that will be most adversely affected by the new Republican Health Care Act is Greg Walden's district, and he's the only representative of the Oregon congressional delegation that endorses this monstrosity. To Greg Walden's constituents and any other Oregonian that voted Republican, all I can say is be careful what you wish for. You may get it. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for showers with temperatures reaching the low 50s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, the rain will give way to a cloudy day with temperatures in the mid-50s. On this date in 1737, Boston became the first American city to celebrate the Feast of St. Patrick, Ireland's patron saint. On this day in 1756, St. Patrick's Day was first celebrated at the Crown and Thistle Tavern in New York City. And with that in mind, we thought we'd take this opportunity to share this old Irish saying, "May your troubles be less, your blessings be more, and nothing but happiness comes through your door."
The Washington Supreme Court has ruled that the Port of Vancouver did follow state law regarding its lease for a proposed oil terminal. Environmental groups had argued that the leases to Tesoro Corporation and Savage Companies were illegal. The groups claimed that the port leased the property before looking at alternatives through the environmental review process. The court did not agree, saying that there are enough contingencies in place to allow for alternatives. Tesoro Savage, operating as Vancouver Energy, is trying to build the nation's largest oil-by-train terminal in Vancouver, Washington. They have repeatedly highlighted the potential economic and employment benefits of the project as they attempt to move through the permitting process. Environmental groups, led by Columbia Riverkeeper, have pointed out that the terminal would require 4 1.5-mile-long oil trains per day. They point to the climate impact associated with burning fossil fuels and the potential for an environmental disaster in the event of a derailment. Yesterday's court ruling allows the permitting process to continue, but final approval rests in the hands of Washington Governor Jay Inslee. Inslee has frequently spoken out against fossil fuels and has already enacted state policies to curb climate change.
Donald Trump has proposed a 31% budget cut for the Environmental Protection Agency. The cut would trim the agency's budget from $8.1 billion to $5.7 billion and cut 3,200 jobs from its staff of 15,000. The budget reduction, which is the steepest among all the federal departments, is in keeping with the philosophy of new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who repeatedly That's my tongue getting twisted. Let me try that again. Is in keeping with the philosophy of the new EPA's administrator, Scott Pruitt, who repeatedly clashed with the agency during his tenure as Oklahoma Attorney General. Pruitt has stated that he wants to restrain what he calls the agency's overreach and returns the work of environmental regulations to the states. And while it may be true that the EPA is best known for broad environmental regulations aimed at clean air, clean water, and climate change, its quiet day-to-day role might be its most important contribution. When states have concerns about possible threats to their water supply or discharges into the air from fires or industrial accidents or pesticide and herbicide poisoning, they reach out to the EPA for help because they lack the capabilities to make the assessments themselves. If the Trump budget is approved, the resource that the states depend on goes away.
Legislatures in states with ongoing or planned pipeline projects are moving to increase penalties for certain types of protests aimed at opposing pipelines. The governor of South Dakota signed a bill into law this week that bars groups of more than 20 people from gathering on public lands. The state senate of Oklahoma is considering HB 1123. It would broaden the definition of trespassing and make peaceful protesters collectively responsible for any property damage during demonstrations. A new pipeline project that is drawing fire from critics is the proposed 550-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline. It would transfer fracked gas from West Virginia across the state and into Virginia and North Carolina. A new pipeline project that is drawing, or rather, activists and members of affected communities in North Carolina are walking the 200-mile section across their state's proposed route ending this Sunday, bringing together Native Americans, Black and white farmers, students, people of faith, and climate organizers. Melinda Tuhus reports from The Walk.
The Walk, organized by the Alliance to Protect Our People and the Places We Live, traverses lower-income counties with high numbers of African American and Indigenous residents on the flat farmlands and swamps of eastern North Carolina. Organizer Steve Norris points out the site of some equipment proposed along the pipeline route on the Virginia-North Carolina border.
Somewhere here is where that compressor station is supposed to be built. And somewhere here is where we're going to stop them from building it. So we need to get walking.
The 42-inch diameter pipeline would carve an 8 to 12-foot trench and a 125-foot construction corridor. It's a project of Duke Energy, one of the world's largest utilities, and Dominion Resources, which would build the pipeline. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission released a draft environmental impact statement last December declaring the project would have, quote, no significant environmental impact, unquote. Locals disagree. The Coalition of Woodland Nations is made up of indigenous people living along the pipeline route, including the 55,000-strong Lumbee tribe, the largest concentration of indigenous people east of the Mississippi. They are asking native peoples around the world to support their fight against the pipeline.
I'm really concerned because I want to preserve as much of our ancestral lands as possible.
Erica Faircloth identifies as Lumbee and has participated in the walk.
These days, it's all about economic development and money, and the Native way has never been about money or developing traditional lands. What we need to be focusing on is remembering our culture and remembering what's important and protecting burial sites and protecting the lands that we do have and not accepting pipelines or oil and gas infrastructure because that was never our way of life.
Several days ended with community rallies. Barbara Exum organized one in Wilson County.
When I was younger, it wasn't very easy for people of color to buy lots and build homes in areas where they wanted to. So my father made the decision to start breaking up our farm and selling lots to people of color to build a community around where I live now. And we've been there for years, and this proposed pipeline would just really decimate our community.
Marvin Winstead is a farmer with Nash County Stop the Pipeline. He says the proposed route perfectly bisects his 70-acre farm.
In the past, it's been a traditional eastern North Carolina tobacco farm.
My father also raised hogs there and so forth, and then rotation crops of wheat, corn, soybeans, cotton, that sort of thing.
Sweet potatoes are another big crop, and he and other farmers say the pipeline running across their land would prevent them from driving semi-trucks onto their fields to load their crops for market. As in other pipeline fights, homeowners are up in arms about state governments using eminent domain to hand over their land to companies if they refuse to grant an easement. They also are wary of the fact that in rural areas, according to the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, pipeline companies are allowed to use steel just over half as thick as what is required closer to population centers, making them feel even more at risk of an accident. Most of the residents or shoppers at small stores the walkers encountered hadn't heard of the pipeline, since the company is required to notify only those whose property it would cross, even though many others would be in the 1,100-foot blast zone or the 2-mile evacuation area. Most were not happy to hear about the plan, but Mike Cook was enthusiastic.
I think it's going to drop gas prices. I think it's going to put people to employed. I mean, it's going to go somewhere, so why not here and bring the economy back in North Carolina? And I mean, they're coming right in front of my house, maybe a half a mile in front of my house. I mean, I got a lot of neighbors who are protesting it, but I think it's a good thing.
Dominion's own documents promise almost 3,000 jobs overall, but only 18 permanent positions in North Carolina, and indicate that half the construction workers would come from out of state. Opponents say the pipeline will probably not lower gas prices locally, as the fuel is likely destined for export, based in part on the fact that there are just 3 planned taps into the pipeline across the whole state, making extraction for local use problematic. And both Dominion and Duke are involved in building liquefied natural gas export terminals. And they say any tax payments to the host counties would be offset by the increases customers would see on their utility bills, as the companies are guaranteed a return on investment of up to 14%. Opponents also dispute the idea that the pipeline needs to, quote, go somewhere. They say it would damage the land, impact their culture and health, and fuel more climate change. The Reverend Mac Ledgerton directs the Center for Community Action in Lumberton, in the heart of the Lumbee community. He says the current route is the third one proposed for this pipeline. The first and second ones were going to go near Durham and Raleigh and would have been more direct and less expensive.
Neither one of those first two proposals were going to touch eastern North Carolina. But, of course, those areas of our state are where there's a lot of wealthy folk and white folk. And in a very short time, with their voices, those two proposals were scratched.
Dominion did not return repeated requests for comment about the pipeline route. Opponents say it's unnecessary because wind and solar installations are growing exponentially and could power the state with none of the harmful impacts of frack gas. The walk wraps up on Sunday. Inspired by other successful campaigns to stop construction of gas pipelines, the activists and their energized neighbors plan to lobby county and state officials and keep up their grassroots campaign across North Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia to stop the pipeline. The 90-day comment period on the draft environmental impact statement ends on April 6th. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Nash County, North Carolina.
The White House has gone on the defensive against the charge that the draconian budget cuts suggested by the administration were particularly harmful to the elderly, the poor, and minority groups. In response to a comment from a reporter asking if the Trump budget was hard-hearted, White House Budget Director Mike Mulvaney responded that, quote, "We're trying to focus on both the recipients of the money and the people who give us the money in the first place," end quote. In Trump's proposed budget, the Department of Housing and Urban Development will potentially lose $6 billion in funding and raise questions about the president's often repeated promise to rebuild the inner cities. Mulvaney responded that cuts to the HUD budget were for new housing units that could be reintroduced later as part of an infrastructure plan. He was then questioned about the extensive cuts to community development block grants. These grants are typically used to help fund programs like Meals on Wheels, which feeds the elderly, and after-school programs that provide food to poor children. Mulvaney stated that he was unwilling to give money to the states that don't work. He said that the states can continue to fund Meals on Wheels if they want, but there was no evidence that feeding kids who are not adequately fed at home was, quote, effective, end quote.
Earlier today, Donald Trump refused to apologize or even back down from his bogus claim that Britain's spy agency secretly monitored him during the presidential campaign at the request of former President Obama. The claim, which was initially made by Press Secretary Sean Spicer, was based on comments made by Fox News commentator Andrew Napolitano. Fox News later backed away from the claim, saying, quote, "Fox News cannot confirm Judge Napolitano's commentary," unquote. Presidential aides apparently tried to calm British officials who were reportedly livid over Spicer's comments. But Trump insisted that he had nothing to retract or apologize for, saying, quote, "You shouldn't be talking to me, you should be talking to Fox." Spicer also refused to apologize, saying, quote, "I don't think we regret anything." Spicer had actually bumped into British Ambassador Kim Darroch at a St. Patrick's Day reception last night, but did not take that opportunity to apologize for the gaffe. Despite producing no evidence, and in face of growing skepticism and criticism from within his own party, Donald Trump continues to insist that he was wiretapped by Obama during the campaign.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you'd like to be part of the KBOO News crew, call or stop by the station. We'd love to have you on the team. Our producer this evening is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News director is Zelos Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM,